Hello, boys and girls. Craig Anthony Harper here. Welcome to this week's episode of The U Project. But before we get underway, I just want to say, hey, Maxes, you rock. And Maxines, you rock as well. Thanks for making this possible and for supporting this little endeavour. Maxes and Maxines are Australia's best-selling sports nutrition range for blokes and girls. They're Australian-owned, Australian-made. They've been around for about 30 years, and in my opinion, they are the best sups on the market in terms of taste, quality and performance. And yes, I actually use them myself and have been using them for about a decade or so. They're amazing tasting protein bars, cookies and powders, great range of high performance formulae or formulas to help you get the most out of every workout and build the body you'll be proud of. They're going to help you train hard, optimize your genetic potential and recover like a superstar. Thanks, Maxes. Thanks, Maxines. And three, and two, and one, and we are live. Hi, everyone. Welcome to The U Project. I'm Craig Harper. This week, we're chatting with Steph Prem. You may or may not know that name. She's a friend of mine. She's represented Australia. She's an elite athlete. Well, she's not anymore. She was an elite athlete. Now she's helping people. Now she's doing some commentating. She's a businesswoman. She's an entrepreneur. She went to the Winter Olympics in 2010. We'll find out what for very soon. And she joins me in the studio. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had. Thanks for popping along to me central.
Always a pleasure.
I saw you on that. Well, I didn't see you. I heard you on the telly a couple of weeks ago just talking about the Winter Olympics.
You just might have.
Just commentating.
Commentating. My old sport.
For yes. Channel 7.
Correct.
Now, what was your sport?
Border cross. So snowboard cross, which was, I believe, the most watched sport of the Winter Olympics this year and the last Olympics too. So border cross is that event which is kind of like motocross on snow, which is six people at a time, carnage, elbows out, race top to bottom,
yeah.
Jumps, berms, turns, berms, you know, obstacle course on snow.
What's a berm? Is that the corner bit?
Like the big corner. Yeah, like the big turn.
So I'm super snowy tech savvy. Yeah,
you were watching. Well done.
Definitely done.
My commentary resonated. Excellent.
Who's the best in the world right now? Is it the person who won? Is it the guy or girl who won the Olympics?
I believe in both sports, actually. It was in my event, my ex-event, I should say, was the best in the world that got across the line. But we, like one of our very own, Jared Hughes, got second at the Olympics
a couple
of weeks ago. Unbelievable.
Was he so, our only silver medalist?
He was.
Yeah, did a great job. Is it a sport or is winter sports in general something that we kind of perform beyond our size, or are we better than we should be considering we're really a sun, surf, sand and coast country?
Absolutely. Yes, I would have to say that. I guess it's not as accessible for us coming from Australia. Yeah. It has changed. There's a lot better facilities in place now, but when I was competing 8 to 12 years ago, it was still kind of like being on the Jamaican bobsled team. Whereas these days we do have better programs in place, but it's not easy coming from Australia.
We've won medals in border cross, in aerials, we've won them in speed skating, obviously,
Stephen
Bradbury, moguls, like in multiple events over lots of Olympics. And really, considering the amount of Australians that spend lots of time in snow, which is not that many, we seem to overperform almost.
I totally agree. I think it's hard. I mean, winter sport's definitely not natural to us, and it's not as easy or accessible or, I guess, accommodating for Aussies to go to the snow.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we are really good at is action sports. And essentially, the winter sports is action sports. So it's most of the sports have transitioned from like your X Games and that kind of format into an Olympic platform now. So I think what Aussies are pretty good at is being quite ruthless, is being quite relentless and having a crack. And that's why I think we tend to do well in winter sports. We're a bit of a never give up kind of attitude when it comes to sports.
And you are, I mean, if somebody looked at you, I don't mean this in any way to sound judgmental, just as in observational. Like if I looked at you and someone went, see that girl over there, she's an Olympic athlete, right?
Yes.
Because that sport is fucking brutal.
It's so funny because I've probably had more contact, I guess, just with the power of social media and obviously being part of the Channel 7 team this year. And when I was actually competing in part of the Olympic Games, you know, 8 years ago, no one really had an idea of what I'd been spending half my life or 10 years of my life training to do.
Yeah.
But fast forward 8 years later now, I'm getting messages and phone calls.
People from going,
ex-family members going, you did what? I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
That's your sport?
Yeah, you did that shit? That is ridiculous.
That's incredible. So it's like I said, it's tough. It's brutal. It is a ruthless sport. And you know, it did put me in the ground in the end, almost. It nearly killed me physically, mentally, emotionally, financially.
Tell us about that. What happened?
Loved it. Loved that sport. But you're right. My body wasn't built for this sport. I think what I lacked physically, I made up for mentally.
Mm.
And I'm just very passionate about snow sports and found something. I mean, you know, I've trained with you in the gym. You can throw a ball at me and you wouldn't know I'm a professional athlete either. I have the hand-eye coordination of an ant. But I'm, but for some reason, balance, agility, speed and action and adrenaline is my thing. And I just found a sport where I could somehow channel that.
Because it's a very power-based, you know, in terms of like you need to be powerful and strong, and there's such punishment on your joints, knees, hips, ankles, spine. It's like it is brutal. And when I, you know, like I said, if I saw you out and about, of course, I know that you did it. I know you're great at it. You know, you represented the country. But you would go, I don't know, maybe a runner or something, you know, because you look athletic, but you look pretty diminutive, you know.
I'm little. Like most of the girls I compete against look like they eat about 72 Weet-Bix for breakfast. I was definitely small for my sport, but I think what I lacked in size, I made up for in speed, because it was a speed and endurance and strength event. So I came from a racing background, so I was always good at speed. I was good around the turns. I was low center of gravity because I'm little.
Yeah.
And then I just had to learn to jump. I had to learn to be better in the air, learn to be better at the freestyle, and combined, that is that sport of border cross. So
what did you do with all of the millions of dollars that you won and all the endorsements, like the millions from the endorsements? What have you done? Do you just, live on the couch now?
You know, between here and the Maldives, it's a tough gig. Definitely you're not in snow sports for the money. That is for sure.
Yeah.
And especially back when I was doing it, there was no female funding. There wasn't a lot of structure in place. It was really, for me, a passion that turned into my profession.
Mm.
I openly and honestly say I wasn't one of those kids that grew up saying, oh, I really want to go to the Olympics, you know, and that's not a bad thing. And I'm really open about that. And when I went to the Olympics, I wasn't saying, I really want to be on the podium. That's not to say I didn't want to win a medal.
Mm.
I love winning. I'm very competitive and I love being on the podium. But when I qualified for the Olympics, I was ranked, you know, my best ranking was top 15 in the world. So I was there and I was amongst it, but I wasn't sort of expecting to be at that level. And even at that level, like as my parents always say to me, had I been top 15 in the world at some good old-fashioned
Aussie sports. Let's go tennis.
Tennis would have been good. Swimming would have been ideal. You know, you become more of a household name, and obviously the financial and the income and all of that come with it. But what I did, honestly, was a passion that turned into a profession, and I just happened to do very well at it and was able to support myself through sponsorships and through some great Australian brands and, you know, just being, I guess, savvy and marketable and able to keep myself going. But by no means can you retire off it, no.
I think one of the good things, and this is going to sound quite contradictory till I finish the whole sentence, one of the good things about being in a kind of a low-profile sport where you really get not much help, and you've got to fund yourself. Did you have to fund yourself to the Olympics?
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous. But anyway, that's ridiculous. But anyway, you're representing our country and paying your way there. Come on, us. Surely we can help. There was no crowdfunding then, was there?
No, there wasn't.
But I think the thing, like, because I've worked with lots of professional athletes like you, but also professional athletes that were in very lucrative sports, you know, AFL, for example, and motor car racing and, you know, a whole bunch, where their whole sense of self and their job is that thing. So they're playing footy, they're being paid an abnormally large wage for a 17 or an 18 year old.
And then
if they're, you know, anywhere like you, which is one of the best, well, you are probably the best or second best in the country, I guess.
Mm.
So imagine if you're the best or second best footballer in the country, you're getting paid whatever, $1 million a year. But the thing is, they come out of that often and there's a depression. So a lot of athletes post career, there's a depression because They were paid all this money. Every week or second week, they got all this adoration and they're signing this and selfies here and selfies there. And it's a pretty public and social thing where, you know, they're being rewarded in lots of ways, but also in lots of ways they get their sense of purpose and who I am from what they do. Whereas you, so you're trying to prepare for the Olympics and you're grinding to make a living. Mm. So I'm wondering when you finished, when you came out of the Olympic experience and went, and your body was a bit fucked up, as you'll tell us about in a minute, mm. did you go, right, that's me, I'm hanging it up? Or whenever you finally did hang it up, were you pretty comfortable with the fact that you were ready to move on? Or was there a real sense of loss and grief?
No, I mean, it's a great question and a loaded one at that. I think, and what you were saying is about how athletes they identify themselves with their sport. And I guess there was a time in my life, absolutely, where I was identified myself with snow sports, with snowboarding. I was a snowboarder. I was a professional snowboarder. That's what I was known as. That's how people refer to me. And I'm still known as the Winter Olympian now, even though I haven't competed or been involved in winter sports for over 8 years now. Mm. So there is always an identity that comes with sport. And I think especially being Australian, we love our... we love sportsmen, you know, sportswomen, sportsmen, and we just get really tied up and we probably put them on podiums as well, which does make it hard. Mm. I left sport not on my own, not by my own accord, on my own choice because of my injury. So I had a horrific injury that took me out of the sport. We can chat about that later. But I guess... It wasn't my choice. So definitely at the start, it was really hard because I probably hadn't taken that next step yet to work out what I was going to do next. Mm. I saw myself in the sport for a little bit longer. But I think because I hadn't completely identified myself with the sport, I'd always had a life outside of it. Like you said, there was always a bit of hustle on the side. Mm. And I worked with this incredible sports psychologist after my accident and after I had to leave sport. Mm. She used to ask me all these poignant questions, which were all about, you know, now do you have good people around you and do you have a good inner circle and are you sure you're okay and are you sure you're okay? Because, I mean, I was born with a chronic case of enthusiasm and positivity. Mm. So for me, even in my darkest hours and my darkest days, I'm still pretty upbeat.
I love that. Chronic enthusiasm and positivity. Yeah. Can you fucking bottle that and sell that?
If only I could. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. So even on a dark day, I think people were always like, you sure you're okay, mate? And look, that's not to say the light didn't fade. You know, at some point there was some really tough, tough days physically, mentally, emotionally. But I think, you know, fast forward now, because there was such a hustle around my sport, I always had a fantastic family and life outside of sport. I was always able to come home. I had very supportive parents and sister and a really nice network of friends. So for me, I always sort of had a life outside of sport. Mm. And I think coming back to your question, that's what a lot of athletes are missing because they just get caught up. They're in the tunnel. You know, it's tunnel vision. You get stuck in it. You've got nowhere to go. You come out the other side and, you know, and you're stuffed. Mm. So I guess there was a lot of transferable skill sets for me from those early days of the so-called hustle.
So, sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I mean, in the middle of all of that, you've got structure, you've got accountability, like with your sport, you've got training, you've got timetables, you've got schedules, you've got managing, traveling around the world, organization, you know, self-awareness, like all of this.
And you wake up one day and it's all gone.
Yeah. But then, which is that bit shit, but the good bit is, I guess, because you didn't have an entourage of 30 people managing you around the world, it was kind of you and your coach and whoever, like all of a sudden you come out of it, but you do bring a lot of skills, a lot of experience and a lot of awareness with you in terms of taking a thing, an idea, a cerebral construct, an intention, a plan, and then turning it into a reality. The idea being maybe I could compete at the Olympics and then ultimately doing that. So maybe I could build a brand, which you've done. Maybe I could build a business, which you've done. Maybe I could be an author, which you're doing. Maybe I could become a reasonably well-paid corporate speaker, which you've done. So how old are you now?
32.
Yeah. So I just think, and also then you go, this is something I think about too, like, you know, we talk about, you know, and then there was, and not discounting in any way what you went through because it's real and it's, you know, but we all go, yeah, and then I had this happen and, you know, my career was taken away from me and, you know, and, oh, you know, and then someone somewhere is listening to this with pancreatic cancer and you go, but then my stuff, not that hard.
Perspective.
You know what I mean?
Perspective. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You go, yeah, it was shit, totally. But I guess in the context of what might be, and we're not discounting, you know, what it was.
No, not
there's
at all.
There's always so let me have a look at that same thing, but from over there.
Yes.
And then you go, all right. Okay. And the thing is too, once you're, whatever happens, you know, if you're injured, if you get diagnosed with something or if you, whatever, like once that's done, like once you've got your injury, what matters then is how you manage yourself and it.
How you cope with it and how you push through.
So tell us what the injury was and when and how it happened.
The injury was literally about 6 weeks after the Olympics. So, you know, touch wood, the timing, at least, you know, I didn't lose the 4 years of hard work prior to that. Competed at the Olympics, wasn't stoked on my result as I could have been, wanted to be. World Cup finals were about 6 weeks later. And, you know, a few of my inner circle said, maybe it's, you know, you're a bit tired, maybe you're a bit burnt out. It's been a big few years getting to this point. Mm. I had a few broken ribs. I came into it a bit battered. And the last race of the season, last jump of the day, last turn of the course, last feature before the finish line, you know, Murphy was not on my side on the day. And I came off, long story short, came off a 60-foot. Jump or 60-foot kicker and missed the landing. So I didn't have the speed on the takeoff. I made a small mistake on the takeoff of the landing. And in my entire, you know, 15 years of professional snowboarding, I'd never had a moment like I had in the air where I went, oh, shit, I'm in trouble. Mm. And when you're in the air and you've got enough time to think, shit, I'm in trouble, you know, you're actually in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as much as it is an action sport and as much as it's a crazy event and anything can happen, it's still calculated to a point. You still know your own ability. Mm. I'm not throwing myself off a 60-foot jump and hoping for the best.
Mm.
I've hit many, many, many 60-foot, 70-foot, 80-foot kickers in my lifetime and at high speeds. You know, traveling at 60, 70 kilometres an hour, the girls, the boys are doing up to 80, 90 kilometres an hour. Mm. So you kind of know what you're coming into it. But I knew coming off that, just I knew immediately in the air, I knew I was in trouble. Mm. And I missed the landing. So there's about a 20-metre gap and I probably came up about 5-6 metres short. So I landed flat. My physio explains it like coming out of a first-floor building to concrete, and because I was quite high, and then I literally took out the whole left side of my body. So
how did you land? Like,
yeah, so
feet first, back first, head first,
back and hip first. Mm. So I sort of sat backwards in the air. So if you imagine I'm coming off on a snowboard, so I'm strapped to a snowboard, and then not the right speed on the takeoff, so my feet went from underneath me, and I couldn't even be like a cat if I tried to get myself back around. It was just no time. No grace. And I just came down sort of on an angle on my back on the left side, and the impact fractured quite a few vertebrae in my spine and compressed a few discs and dislocated my hip and broke 5 ribs and tore my hamstring and just literally took, and the spinal whiplash was just horrendous and took out the whole pretty much left side of my body.
That is like a severe car accident for one. Two,
very similar.
Two,
I've been told.
You broke your back.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially.
Well, you did. If you broke vertebrae.
Yes.
That's class. So
I was very lucky.
You could have been
a
paraplegic or a quadriplegic or.
Very, very lucky.
And
anyone who watched the recent Olympics would have seen some of the carnage, some of the accidents and the risk that these guys... And look, the girls, we're racing on the same course as the boys.
Mm.
So they're not forgiving features.
Mm.
And especially now that it has transitioned from like an X Games to an Olympic event, it's all about the TV.
Mm.
You know, so it's all about, especially with the Olympics, they're bigger, they're better, they're made for, you know, for people watching. And there's a reason why it's the most watched sport. It's carnage, you know. It's just people like the spectacle of it. It's a fantastic sport to watch.
Mm.
Just wasn't as forgiving being part of it.
So you're on the ground, you're in 13 pieces, and people are standing over you going, fucking, what do we do?
I'm in another country, so it was in another language.
You're in another country, and happens next?
Well, I think we'll fast forward a little bit, but long story short, I was bedridden, so I was in Europe when I had the accident. So I was bedridden for a couple of months until I was able to fly home. I was covered in hematomas, so I wasn't allowed to fly until I got clearance. So I was probably bedridden for about 6 weeks and then flew home about 8 weeks later and then came home and saw, you know, my sort of team of people that I knew and trusted back home.
So no surgeries?
I've had minors since, but at the time we didn't know the severity of it. At the time it was, you know, my team of experts and insurance and everything else was back home. So it was all about getting home and working out what the actual extent of the injury was. I've had numerous cortisone injections in my spine. I've had done some pretty severe nerve damage. So I've had a few nerve ending operations.
Yeah.
And otherwise I've just rehabbed the hell out of it. Yeah. I didn't want to have anything more serious. And it was always sort of hope I never have to get to that point. But I've been diligently looking after it since, took up clinical Pilates quite religiously, and which I thought at the time, being an action sports, you know, person that I was, that I would find that side of corrective exercise and clinical side of exercise quite boring. But I didn't. I actually really kind of came to love the experience and enjoy that side of it, and you know, has led to a lot of great things for what I do and how I do them now. But, you know, it was a hard, I'm still in rehab now. I still look after myself. But like you said, perspective is a great thing. I'm healthy. I'm happy. I'm back on my snowboard. You know, I had to take 2 years off my board. That for me was harder than the getting up every morning at 5, 6 a.m. and doing the rehab. Not being on my board and not being, and just that, I guess that hard moment of realizing I would never return to professional sports was a very hard pill to swallow.
Just stepping back 30 seconds, what's clinical Pilates? What's the difference between that and run-of-the-mill Pilates?
I think because Pilates is pretty trending at the moment. You know, it's a bit hot topic at the moment. So mass market Pilates is kind of your thing at the moment, where they've got, you know, 10 to 20 beds in a room. And by beds, I mean reformer Pilates.
Those
beds.
Sliding uppy down things?
Yeah, yeah. Those, you know, those contraptions that can look quite intimidating until you've been on one and then you go, oh, how good does this feel? So technically, clinical Pilates is a small program based on you and your body and what it needs in that moment at that time and how you can work to fix normally an injury.
So do you use those beds or you work on the floor?
I both. But right. I use the beds and I have the beds in my business now. I used to be all floor based, but I absolutely love and adore the beds.
And the beds you're working against, kind of your own resistance or your own body weight?
You've got resistance on the beds as well.
Right, so you can vary it.
You're laying on your back, so you're working with gravity, not against gravity. So your core is engaged. You have to engage your core essentially to do any exercise on the bed. Joseph Pilates, the man that invented Pilates, is a genius. And he kind of invented the Pilates machine because if anyone that's seen a Pilates bed before, if you've got a visual of a Pilates bed or look one up, it's got springs and they kind of look like bed springs, what you would see under your mattress on them. And that's the resistance springs you use. And a genius man called Joseph Pilates invented it. And he was using actual bed springs back in the day to help war veterans get back. So the hospital beds, he was pulling the springs out of hospital beds and attaching them above the war veterans that couldn't get out of bed and letting them use them to rehab their body.
As a form of resistance
and functional strength training. So it's, you know, it comes from that real, that's the clinical element of it, the rehabilitation side of it, but it has, you know, transitioned its way into sort of modern fitness hype these days, which is all good and well, but there's definitely still a huge place for that small group.
So let's talk about, motivation versus discipline versus commitment versus buying into a process. I mean, so everyone who's listening to you is going, not everyone, but some people are going, that's interesting. Yeah, but I'm not Olympian. I'm not a snowboarder. I'm not elite. Some people might be, some people aren't. I'm in the aren't category. How do we, like, what's your take on, now I know that you have a studio called Studio PP. I also know that you, I'm a big advocate for women's health and that you're an expert in that space and you get called upon to do lots of things. So you're a bit of a voice in that area, which is great. But so the average person who comes and goes, you know what, I'm not going to make the Olympics. I'm not going to be 3% body fat. Neither do I want to be. And I don't care about my abs or I don't care about my Instagram profile. I just want to be fitter, healthier, leaner.
Sound like my kind of people.
I have a history of almost getting in shape or getting in shape, then getting out of shape. And I don't want to do that anymore. How do we stay productive and proactive? How do we keep doing the thing that we need to do when our history says, oh, you're probably not going to do that in the future because you've started and stopped 37 times?
It's a great question. I mean, for me, I probably had never experienced it up until leaving sport when I was forced to start again and I had to kind of rebuild my body again. So I kind of, I guess everything I took for granted with my body and how well it worked, I lost.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to kind of put myself back together again. And in that process, I met all these awesome women and awesome people that were kind of trying to do the same thing. And they might not have been rehabbing a back injury as such, but they might have just been coming back to fitness, or they might have been, you know, had a bit of, you know, the empty nest syndrome, and now they've found themselves again. They're trying to get back into health and fitness, like you said, that almost category. And for me, you know, I'd never had that kind of negative headspace where you can just completely get caught in your head.
Mm.
And it's not about the physical and what you're capable of and how you can do it, which most of us have. Mm. But for some reason, we can't find the get up and go to make it happen. Mm. So it gave me a really, really good new perspective on all of that, because I used to just love sport,
yeah,
and love health and wellness, and that was all good and well. But then I lost it and I hated health and wellness.
And then you're stepping into something that you have to do, not something you're passionate about.
Correct. So very different level, different ground. And I think, you know, the biggest thing in the health and fitness industry at the moment, or the, which is, you know, a bit of a direction which can be a little bit scary too, is that whole aesthetic approach to health and wellness. And people want to look a certain way as opposed to feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And they forget about, you know, the mental, emotional aspects of health and fitness, as opposed to just, like you said, turning up and, you know, updating your Instagram profile and working on your abdominals. So, you know, I'd like to think that I'm somewhere in the middle and kind of help those everyday people that are just trying to really feel good in their bodies again, and get that physical, emotional, mental, I guess, gain from being a healthy person. Don't have to be fit. You don't have to be elite. You don't have to be an Olympian.
Mm.
You know, you just have to have some kind of health and well-being approach to your everyday life. And that comes from, like you said, things like discipline. It comes from things like non-negotiables. It comes from, you know, you don't always have motivation. You're not always going to have it.
Yeah.
So
creating habits.
Creating habits.
You know, when something's hardwired, you don't have to get motivated.
You brush your teeth every day.
Mm.
Why can't you get up and go for a walk every day? So it's just, for me, I call them the one percenters. And in sport, I had to always find the one percenters. I mentioned the Jamaican bobsled team earlier. Like coming from winter sports in Australia was not easy.
Yeah.
So I was constantly, you know, it wasn't even about the competitors. It was about finding that extra 1% in me that I could find to better myself, to do better.
Have you listened to a dude called David Goggins? Have you heard of a guy called David Goggins? So David Goggins was, and folks, you know, I'm happy to promote anything. I don't know David Goggins, and I don't know Joe Rogan, but I love Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
And he was a week or so ago, he's on Joe's podcast, and he was talking about, so this guy's an ex-Navy SEAL. I think he was also in the Rangers, Special Forces, elite, super elite. But he came from a background of, like, tough, like violent, abusive, alcoholic, shit father, who was, if he was not beating him, he was absent. And a mum who really struggled, a mum that loved him but struggled. He dropped out of school very young. He ended up weighing, because it's an American show, they talk in pounds, 297 pounds. So let's say 140, yeah, about say 135 kilos at about 6 foot tall. So, you know, and just went through all this shit and couldn't write, couldn't read. And anyway, he managed to get himself, I think it's, if you want to have a listen, folks, that's podcast. This sounds funny, me coming from my podcast, but I just like to share good information. I think it's podcast 1080 on JRE, the Joe Rogan Experience. It's fucking amazing. I love it. Anyway, he talks about strength of mind, and he talks about mindset. And I believe, and this is going a bit deep and philosophical, but it's true. It's like I always say, I always teach my groups, you know, we exist and operate in two worlds, a physical three-dimensional world where we're sitting in this studio now, we're talking into microphones, we're leaning on a solid desk, you're playing with your phone, which I told you not to do. I'm only kidding. We've got these lights shining on us. We've got Melissa sitting up there at her computer with her buttons and things that she does. you know, it's all. And then there's the other part, which is thinking, feeling, emotions, fears, goals, objectives, self-talk, self-management, self-love, self-loathing. You know, and he talks about essentially managing your mind to manage your life. Then he talks about this thing, and this is relevant to what we're saying, where you're talking about people who join a gym and, you know, people go, I'm not a gym person, or I hate exercise or whatever. And we're not saying, hey, you got to love, you got to love exercise. No, you don't. You just, maybe it's a good thing because your body benefits from being moved. So whether that's at the gym or at the park or at the hill or at the pool, doesn't matter. You never have to have a trainer. You never need to go to one of my gyms back in the day, or as long as you move your body and self-manage, so that not so that you're elite, or but just so that you look after yourself.
I think optimal performance exists in an everyday human.
100%. Yeah, and it's optimal. It's optimal for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's a personal.
So he said he was talking about intensity, and he didn't use this term, but this is the way I term it. He said that people mistake discomfort for threshold. Right.
I like that.
Right? And in other words, people think they're at 100, they're at 40. Right?
Yeah.
And discomfort it's versus... it's so interesting that we have an aversion in our culture. I'm talking generally, I'm not talking
getting
everyone to discomfort, where we just fucking hate. Mm-hmm. You know, but the practical truth is that, you know, like all your training, all your preparation, your injuries, your recovery, you're building your brand, you're building your business, you're having hard conversations. Like, I remember when you were going through the process where you got your joint and you're renovating it and you're going back and forwards and there's council stuff and there's landlord stuff and there's money stuff and there's, you know, it's just hard. Mm. Like, here's the truth.
Mm.
Life's hard.
Mm.
Or at least some of life's hard. Sport, hard. Building a brand, hard. Getting in shape, hard. Mm. Right? Obviously hard and not hard is subjective. But the point is that a lot of what we need to do, or some of what we need to do to get where we want to go, is just fucking uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Mm. But while we're hardwired for comfort...
We are so hardwired for comfort.
Yep. Mm. And this is the problem. And we can't grow, we can't learn, we can't evolve at the rate that we should be because we're so self-protecting. Anything that's unfamiliar, anything that's uncertain, anything that's uncomfortable, anything that we don't recognize or want to be,
convenient. Everything's convenient now as well.
And that's actually a problem, you know. And I just think whether or not, you know, like for me, like I've written a bunch of books, like writing a book, people go, oh, I want to write a book. I go, you know what? You actually probably don't. Like you sit down, I'll describe to you writing a book, you know, and like my last book was 80,000 words and I just described the process. It's fucking mind-numbingly not fun. Mm-hmm. Trust. I mean, actually, I'm not talking about taking bits and pieces from other people. I'm talking about sitting with a fucking blank screen and going, the beginning. And then writing 150,000 words to cull to 80,000 good words, which is 280 pages, and then having all of those 80,000 words with no grammatical errors, no mistakes. It's interesting. It's captivating. It flows. There's a just that is hard, right? And you know, I just sometimes, and not because I'm frustrated for me, I'm frustrated for them because I see people with amazing potential. An amazing intelligence, and amazing gifts, and amazing even resources and support, but they tell themselves stories about what they can and can't do, or what's hard and what's
not. No, take the opportunity.
No, just I'm so passionate about humans exploring their potential, which is the reason for this podcast. I'm so passionate about people going, what's actually possible for me? Not what's comfortable, not what's quick or easy or familiar.
Some people don't even ask themselves the question.
I know.
Which blows my mind.
Mm.
I'm the same with performance. Like I'm obsessed with performance and getting the best performance out of people.
Yes.
Some people don't want to get the best performance out of themselves.
I think if you said, you know, here's what I often say this in a room. I go, put up your hand if you want to be the best version of you that you can be.
Mm.
And everyone puts up their hand. Mm. And I said... Put up your hand if your goal is to, I say, put up your hand if your goal is to be, I mean, based on your possibilities and potential and you, not compared to anyone, but for you.
Your ability.
Yeah, you want to be, put up your hand if your goal is mediocre. Everyone goes, fuck off.
A sea of hands.
Yeah.
Not.
And then you go, who wants to be exceptional? And everyone puts up their hand. I go, cool, what does that mean? They're like, what? I go, well, you want it. What does it mean? Mm. Well, let's start with this. Being exceptional means you'll do what most people won't do. That makes you the exception.
Makes you the exception to the rule.
Yeah. What won't most people do? Get uncomfortable. What won't they do? Make hard decisions. What won't they do? Persevere when they can't be fucked. What won't they do? Ask great questions. What won't they do? Be humble. What won't they do? They won't say, I fucked up.
Have the hard conversations. Push through when you have to push through. Make the hard calls. It's a lot of people will avoid all of those things.
Do you feel like...
A detriment to themselves.
Do you feel like some of the people... And again, folks, I'm not on any level trying to be insulting. I'm just trying to talk about just a literal issue that I've dealt with for 30 years. Mm. I had lots of people who came to me who wanted the result, but they didn't want to do the work. Mm. And they'd say, oh, I want to do this. And I'd go, cool, here's what you need to do. And they're like, oh, really? Mm. I go, yeah, yeah.
I think everyone's looking for the quick fix. Mm. I think we're obsessed, or as a society, obsessed with the quick fix. So everyone's trying to take a shortcut to be exceptional. Mm. And I don't think there is a shortcut to being exceptional. It's just like running a business or doing, you're never off.
Mm.
You're always on. So you're constantly working at the project, whether it's yourself, whether it's your business, whether it's wherever your focus lies. It's a constant project. There's no quick fix. It's not going to, you can't just achieve something and then it will appear and stay the way it is forever.
And the truth is that there's, you know, whether or not it's running a business or building your best body or building your best mindset or
building,
you know,
best brand, whatever it may
be. For a lot of things there actually is no destination. There's no ta-da, I'm here.
Well, it's like you were talking about writing the book before. I had a girlfriend of mine, am writing a book at the moment, and I had a girlfriend of mine who's written a few books say to me recently, she goes, well, You do know that you know there's no money in writing books, right? You do know that. I was like, well, I'm not writing it to make money, but it's the same thing. I wasn't going to the Olympics to make money.
Mm.
I was going to the Olympics because I wanted to do the best I could possibly do at my sport.
I'll tell your friend that's kind of bullshit because lots of people have made fucking lots of money.
Correct, but as in, you know, that's not why you decide to be an author that you can, you know.
True. I agree with her. But, you know, done the right way.
And she wasn't being negative. She was just saying this is, you know, it's a great platform 100%. And it's wonderful, this and that. But it's I guess, if there's always, you know, I'm not doing it for the money. It's just like, if you're doing it just to lose weight, that's not going to give you the result you want to do. You're not going to feel, you know, mentally and emotionally sound either if you just do it for the weight loss. There's always a byproduct, you know, and you just have what's the focus?
Look, I think your girlfriend's 100% right in that it is true that most people won't make money. The vast majority won't make money. So, you know, I agree with that. And it's I think the thing is that everything, whether or not it's building your brand or writing a book or losing 30 kilos or, you know, just having that hard conversation or getting out of a relationship that you know you should have got out of 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
It's the doing of the thing which is the real value. It's not even the achieving of the, you know, it's totally. Like when I wrote a book.
How enjoyable is it to write a book?
Yeah, not much. Look, sometimes when you're in this.
And it's cathartic and there's a lot of good elements.
But there's times
it.
Where you're like, fuck, this is a grind this because I've got to do 2,000 words today to stay on track, you know.
It's like running a business. You know you have to make a certain amount of money to stay ahead or do what you need to do.
Mm.
You're not doing it because of that. I actually enjoy going to my job half the time, most of the time. But there's always those other elements, the hard parts, those hard parts that people don't want to do, don't want to hold on to or push through to make the other stuff happen.
Mm. And I think that it's like I'm doing a workshop, which the first one is in Sydney on what date? 18th. The 18th, thank you. And then where do we go after that? Brisbane, Bris Vegas on the 25th. But anyway, it's called What the Fuck Am I Doing With My Life, right?
Good title. Thanks.
And it came out of, and I'm coming back to what we're talking about, came out of just lots of conversations with people, but everyone from 25 to 65, it's older, going, like, I've ticked lots of boxes, but I still feel like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? I go, well, that's a big club. Me too.
Yeah.
At times. And... You know, sometimes in the middle of all of that, the question is not really so much as what am I doing with my life, but what am I doing with me?
Mm-hmm. Like, spot on.
What am I like? Is this actually, is my life the problem? And again, not about self-loathing, just self-awareness and honesty. Is my life really the problem? Like, compared to that little dude who lives in the Sudan, how's he tracking? And how am I going? Well, pretty good.
I'm actually all right.
If we're just talking about, you know, stuff, like I've got, and of course, life's about more than just having stuff, of course. But is it my life that needs to change drastically, or is it me that perhaps needs to change my operating system, or the way I think, or the stories I tell?
Is hard. No one wants to look at themselves.
Yeah.
People are very good at looking at what's happening around them, I think, and pointing fingers and blame as to what's happening around them. Like you said, I think you said it beautifully before, the storytelling, the things people tell themselves, we see it with our clients, you know, the things that, and we do it ourselves.
Of course.
You know, you tell yourself these things, we can justify anything to get out of anything.
I do it. And even when I'm doing it, I go, I'm full of shit right now.
And self-awareness is there. I know. You're aware you're doing it. You're like, I know I'm doing this right now and I should be doing something else and I could be doing better, but I'm going to still choose to do this.
Yeah, and we do that. And I do it because if I go, no, that's actually legit, then I've got to step up. And I go, can't be fucked stepping up right now. I'll CBF, do it. I'll do CBF. It. I'll do it Monday.
Yeah, right. Doesn't everyone go, there's always Monday. There's always Monday.
The stuff starting day.
Yeah, the stuff starting day. New Year's Eve's good day. Good day to refresh your life. Just hit the refresh button.
Yeah, no, that works well.
On 2018 or 2019. Wait for December 31st.
What have you learned? So for people who, a lot of people that I talk to, think about, have been thinking about, or are starting their own business brand, and it might be something as simple as a lawn mowing round through to an online business through to a bricks and mortar business with 50 staff, and it's a restaurant and we're spending $2 million on setup or so what have you learned building a business, building a brand? You've got your studio, you've got a pretty big team. I've come and spoken to your team, they're lovely. You're building an online business and programs as well, which we'll talk about before we wind up. What for you has kind of gone, fuck, I didn't know this? Or if you jumped into a new business now, you'd be so much more prepared and skilled.
So much more equipped. I think, again, speaking to another friend recently, compared it to like having a child, which I do not have. I call my business my child. Studio PP is my baby. And my baby's about to turn 3 years old. And I think in those first few years of infancy, it is like this child or baby that requires your attention and your assistance 24/7. And it takes everything you have to manage it, to look after it emotionally, mentally, financially, like your capacity is at its absolute maximum. And I think that goes for many small business owners or big business owners or entrepreneurs or whatever it is. And it's being able to learn how to manage that. And for me, I think early on, the naivety of going into what I went into probably helped me push through. My business grew quite quickly, organically, but quickly. And I probably wasn't ready for the growth early on. And I had to learn, and I had to learn quickly, and I had to work my tits off to try and keep up. And no one teaches you about staff management in school. I didn't study business at school.
I was in professional sports. You really need to study bloody behavioral psychology.
Behavioral psychology and people. How do you study people, right? The biggest one for me is obviously putting a good team around you. And I try to always revert back to my transferable skills from sport, which is having people around you that believe in you and what you're doing. Because if you don't have that, you'll never be able to go anywhere. It's about having some sort of discipline. And mine went completely out the window in my first year of business. I was consumed by my business. I let it absolutely eat me in the first year.
Can I say that in the last 3 years, you've probably sent me 500 questions?
A month? A month?
Like, I got one today and it was, I won't say the question, of course, but it was like, what do you think? And like, you're like, yep, thanks.
Thanks.
I like that though. I like that.
And sometimes you just need a sounding board.
100%.
Like, I went into my business on my own, which I think a lot of small business owners do, which sometimes I think is really stupid. And sometimes I think is really great because there's a lot of upsides and there's a lot of downsides. Like, I love what I do. I really, really enjoy my job. I love the people I work with. Like, I do it for the people. I'm a real people person. I love and adore my clients. And
just hit the pause button. How does that "I love my people"? Because you are a very warm, emotionally intelligent. I'm almost going to say, you know, I love you, but almost people pleasing sometimes. How does that go? Because you want everyone to love you, because you love everyone, and you're this energizer bunny. How does that go with being, "Hey, Sally, you can't do that anymore. That's shit. We need to have a conversation." And I'm not jumping up and down. I'm not mad. I'm just telling you that's not okay. How do those conversations go for you?
They're always tough. I think, like you said earlier, I think only because of what I've been through and how I've learnt along the way organically and just time, I guess, over time you get better, you learn more. I can ask questions. I always ask questions. I ask you 100. If I'm asking you 100, I'm asking someone else 100 questions. I'm open-minded. I'm always open to learning how I can do things better. I learn if I fuck one thing up, I learn how to do it better the next time. So, you know, how I managed things 3 years ago is so completely different to how I manage something now. And I don't think you get it right. And I wouldn't say I'm perfect at it. I'm definitely just trying to get better at that confrontation, trying to get better at managing a team. You know, not being best mates with everyone is really hard. And I think everyone comes into the health and fitness industry thinking everyone's going to be best friends. But at the same time, I think people also forget that I was in elite sports for a lot of my life. So, like, you don't turn up to the Olympics trying to make mates either.
Yeah.
Like, we always had this saying, is like, there's no friends on race day.
Yeah.
And, you know, my coach used to always joke and say to me, like, he'd put Metallica on in the car on the way to a race, because I'd have like Britney Spears or like Ministry of Sound playing to pump me up in the car, and he'd switch it off and put Metallica on and be like, "You need to harden up." Now, remember, we're not here to make friends.
Yeah.
You're here to make some mess today, you know?
Yeah.
So he'd really pull me up on that and constantly remind me, because something about, you said it a lot more eloquently than I will, but something about my energy is quite contagious, and it might be that that excessive amount of enthusiasm that I was born with, that I've got enough to go around sometimes, and it sometimes leaks out of me and it attracts people towards me that want to be around me, because I am positive and I'm happy and I'm pretty, you know, excitable to be around. And that used to get me in trouble at races. It used to get me in trouble in elite sports sometimes, because everyone would want to feed that off that, because
I'd be feeling nightclubs.
Feeling good. Nightclubs, not as much. But my nightclub life was short-lived. And then, you know, I thought I'd be enjoying that a lot more post-sports. But, you know, the whole back thing put a real dint on my high heels and nightclubbing lifestyle.
Bugger.
But, you know, and then I sometimes can have the same issues in business, absolutely, because I get very close to the people I work with. I invest in them. And they can invest in me, and it's very hard to have the hard conversations sometimes. But I guess all I can say is I just try to get better at it. I don't know if there's a rhythm or a rhyme or a secret. I'm still trying to learn it all myself.
So through good fortune or good management, what's one thing that you did really well, just either fluked it or consciously created it in business when you start out? One thing you did well and one thing you fucked up. You might have covered it already, but in business in the first year or two, this is one thing that worked really well. So for people who are, because I want to encourage people, I think more people should have their own business. And I'm pretty biased because I've had my own business for 28 years. And I just think there are a lot of people working for people that shouldn't be.
Agreed.
Right? I think there are some people that are really, and there's nothing wrong with working for people, by the way. I think it's great. I think some people, that's the best option. That's the best plan. I think for other people, maybe they're slightly wired slightly differently. I'm one of those people. I would rather make less money and work for me and do stuff and have freedom when I work, how I work, what I create, what works, what doesn't, you know. But I also think, you know, there are people that a traditional model of having a job, going to work, suiting up, showing up works for. And there are some people that doesn't work for. So again, no judgment, but I meet lots of people who feel and articulate and seem to me they're trapped in this fucking paradigm that they hate it. And, how long have you hated it? 13 years. I'm like, geez, so for people who are thinking, yeah, that's all good, but I don't know when, how to start. So if somebody's thinking about starting a business, and I think I've jumped onto another question, sorry, but
I'll come back to that.
Where would they start? What, just give somebody a hint.
At the power of doing, I always say. I could have easily said I wasn't going to do well in sports. It would have been very easy to not do well in sport, but I decided to do well in sport. If you want to do well in sport, you do a great deal more sport and you get better at it and you learn. I had a conversation with staff member the other day who just fills in for me occasionally because she has a full-time job outside of us.
Yeah.
But she's also got this side project and passion for health and fitness and sometimes comes and helps out in the business.
Yeah.
And I had this coffee and it blew my mind the other day because I had this coffee with her and she said to me, oh, I just, you know, I'd love to be like you guys.
Really?
I said, what do you mean? Oh, you know, you guys are just so positive to be around. It's such a nice industry and it's just so wonderful. I said, but you come and work for me part-time. You are one of us.
Yeah.
She said, oh, no, well, full-time, I'm this. And I said, well, you got to look at your, you know, you got to make a list of the things that make you happy in life and then you got to make a list of the things that don't. And if your don'ts are outweighing your do's, then you're not doing the right thing.
So good.
And so I'm like, so how do you change it? And I was like, come work for us then. So quit your job and come work for, like.
Yeah.
And she just looked at me like I'd told her to go to Mars.
Yeah.
But I meant it. I wasn't making it up. I was like, honestly, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why are you thinking about it? You just told me exactly what you're trying to execute. Yeah. You told me what you want to be.
I told you exactly
where you want to go.
And I told you how to do it. And I just told you how to do it.
And now you're looking at me like I'm the moron. So not like that. But it was just this shockwave. And I think, and that must be so common in so many people that see where they want to go, have an idea of where they want to be, but for some reason they're just not jumping in. So it's fear-based.
It's fear, yeah.
Absolutely fear-based. And look, when I started my business, there was so much fear. I jumped into a very saturated industry. My strength came from sport, not in what I do now. Obviously, there was a lot of crossover. Mm. But at the end of the day, I knew from sport, you have to do the hours, you have to do the work, and eventually you will get somewhere and you will do well at it. And your idea of doing well is very different to Melissa's idea of doing well or Craig's idea of doing well. So you have to be doing well for you. And if it's what you kind of set out to do, then aren't you doing well?
I think with a lot of people, they love the idea of what you do.
Correct.
They love the idea. They love the thought. But the thing is, I always say this to my groups, well, what is it that you want? So identify the thing that you want. Then before you do anything else, identify the cost. Because everything might be time, might be effort, might be energy, might be relationships, it might be money, it might be blood, sweat and tears, physical exertion, whatever, right? There's like, if it's a pair of shoes or a business, if it's a cup of coffee or overcoming addiction, there's a cost. Mm-hmm. Now, the most important question before we even think about progressing is, will you genuinely pay that price? Will you genuinely invest that money or that time or that energy and keep investing and keep investing and keep investing till you create, till there's a physical thing. And you know, it's just like I spoke to a guy yesterday who wants to do what I do, which is be a professional speaker. And he's good. He's got lots of potential. And we're just talking about stuff. And I said, mate, you can't do 5 years in a year. You can only do 5 years in 5 years.
That's true.
Right? Correct. People want to do what, and that's not to say that people don't, succeed at different rates. Of course they do. But like some people come and talk to me and know a bit of my backstory and understand what I do, and they want to achieve what I've achieved in 20 years. They want to do it by, mid next year.
Yesterday.
Like I go, so well, what, 16 months you want to do what I did in 20 years? Mm. Now, maybe they can do that. Maybe they're a genius. But probably not, right? Mm-hmm. And I go, well, look, this is what it took me, and I probably have a natural talent for it. Doesn't mean I'm brilliant. I'm definitely not. Mm-hmm. But my natural default setting is communication, connection, kind of understanding human behavior pretty well. I've got an exercise science degree and lots of experience in this, and I take all that kind of starting point, and then I wrap it around 20 years of fucking grind, and here we are today.
Hello.
Yeah.
Overnight success.
Yeah.
Craig Harper.
30 years of grind. But, and it's not, aren't I terrific? I'm not. It's just that, like, anyone gets the opportunity.
You've done the grind.
To
You've
do the work. That's
correct.
It. That's it.
Some people are not willing to do the work. It's like when you would have run a gym. People come to you and go, I need to lose 10 kilos yesterday.
100%.
It's like you're not willing to do the work.
People used to come to my gym, which at that time, Harper's on the Pearn Highway in Brighton, was the biggest personal training facility in the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm.
And they would want to copy us. And they'd come up and literally, you know, they'd do all this kind of recon and stuff, like to, and pretending they're a client. I'm like, well, you're a 25-year-old dude. You're jacked. You've got abs and you're 90 kilos and 4% body fat. I'm pretty sure you're not a potential client. What do you actually want to know? And then they go, oh, I go, mate, ask me anything. Take pictures.
Scope away.
They'd ask me 100 questions. Mm-hmm. They'd take photos of the gym and the setup. They'd talk to my trainers.
Yeah, I see that all the time.
And then they'd go away and not do it because they want it done by Wednesday. You know, and they want to be where I am. It just, it's like.
Well, they start looking into it and realize it's actually quite hard.
And that's the part of it is just the acceptance that there's work to do, which is cool. We can all do work. There's discomfort to walk into. There's fears to face, you know, and that's part of the challenge moving forward.
And I think people don't realize that you and I are constantly working, you know, we're not perfect either. And just because we have a business or have had businesses or have had some level of success in whatever it is we have done does not mean that it we wake up every day like feeling like Susie Sunshine. There's still discomfort. There's still a great deal of hard work. Some days I go to work and I just go, oh, shit, how good is my job? Some days I leave my office and think about lighting a match. You know, so it's a and it's a battle. And I think that comes with running your own business and managing people and looking after clients and just constantly turning up every day, wanting to give your best.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm like A-type personality one-on-one. So when I want to do something, I want to do it well.
Yeah.
The, you know, the professional athlete still lives within me. Although she's not competing, she's now competing in in a, just a different aspect of
life. Yeah, you're still competing, but not so, at that. Yeah. Not at and that level. I think, so, I actually think further to your point that we're not like, I'm definitely not, I'm pretty flawed. Like, but I've
but
got,
aren't we all? Like, I've never.
Yeah,
never
but I mean, like you're very talented. I'm not very talented, and I'm not saying that in a self-deprecating. You've got like you competed at the Olympics. That's talent.
This is funny though, because I'm going to say this is what you said to me before I went to the Olympics. You were training me in the gym, and someone asked if they could interview you about my training, and you said to them that you said this. You said something about this body not being built to do well in sport, like. Like, you know, biomechanically, anatomically, I'm not built to be a professional athlete.
Well, not at that sport anyway.
But there's potential. I'm going to fucking squeeze every inch of it out of her if I can. So, you know.
Yeah, but you do. Yeah, look, you are right. I mean, I think a lot of you, of course, you have inherent talent and ability, but you did squeeze every fucking ounce out, right? Whereas what I mean is for... Like, because, like, I didn't fly. In fact, I fucked around at school. The only time I put in any effort was when I went to uni later. Like, for me, school was like a 13-year holiday. So I was terrible. I'm like, I just used to fuck around. Anyway, how I didn't get kicked out 17 times, I don't know. But, you know, because I've never, you know, I'm not a fast runner. I'm not a good athlete. I'm not a good singer. I don't have, you know, I'm not a genius. I'm not... But I'm okay at a bunch of things. But for me, that was that mediocrity of my that default mediocrity was actually the catalyst I needed.
Yep.
I reckon if I was super gifted, I would have been lazy.
And I reckon the same thing. I was surrounded by athletes that were gifted.
Yeah, right.
Gifted at my sport. Yeah. Like these girls were just built to do well in sport. But it got to a certain, I guess, time and age in our sport where they just wanted to be out at the nightclubs. They wanted to be people pleasing. They wanted to be out with the boys, or they wanted to be, they felt that that fear of missing out in other aspects of life
was
overriding the ability to channel that talent and use it in where it could have been, you know, really used really, really well.
Yeah.
I never had that. I did work hard as well. I just, you know, wasn't built for it, but fuck, I loved it, you know. And I think if you're not passionate about what you're doing and you're passionate, like what you lack in whatever you're saying you are lacking, which I struggle to believe some of it, but, you know, you make up for in passion. You're the most passionate person you'll ever meet. And just if you've worked with you or talk with you or it resonates, it comes out of you, you love what you do. And I think if you don't have some level of that, then you're in a bit of trouble. And like you said, everyone should own a business. If you're passionate about something, then yes, you should be doing something about that or turning it into your lifestyle, your passion, your business, whatever it may be. But without it, you're in a bit of trouble.
100%. 100%. And I think that's almost the catalyst. Yeah, go on.
You asked me two things before and we didn't answer them.
And, they,
and I'm only curious because I want to know yours
sure,
as
go.
Well. And you asked me what I did.
What did you do well and what did you fuck up in the first year of your business?
I'll go the fuck up first.
Right.
Was myself.
Yeah.
I completely fucked myself up in the first year of business.
Because you didn't manage you?
Did not manage me.
Yeah.
So, and I, you know, this is a lot of what I speak about when I do corporate speaking too, is like when you're not well, the business of you is not well. So you and everything around you starts to come apart. And I felt that massively in my first year of business because I just wasn't operating at what I could operate at and I wasn't looking after myself. And you talk a lot about Joe Rogan and all these guys that you love. I'm a big fan of Arianna Huffington and she's, you know, she's all about corporate wellness now and look at, and the, you know, the power of you and looking after yourself. And there's this, it's not even a chapter in her book. It's like a one liner, but it just always stood out to me. It talks about putting deposits in your health bank.
Yeah.
And I just, I love it because it's all about, you know, when your credit card's maxed out, what do you do? You know, where do you go after that? There's nowhere to where you can get another credit card. There's always, you know, you can find something, you can 100%. Borrow money, you can do something, but it's like your body. If you just deplete all the time and you're not restoring or you're not putting deposits in, then eventually you're going to go bankrupt.
Correct.
Eventually you're going to implode. And I got myself to that point. So, you know, I went from professional athlete to professional burnout very quickly and learnt the hard way about not looking after myself and those around me.
That
was the biggest one.
That's the thing that I talk about corporately. Like I don't talk about professional development. I talk about personal development in a professional setting with corporates.
Yes.
And so the I've kind of scammed my way into this because I can talk to any company in any industry comfortably because I don't have to talk about what they do. I don't have to talk about the specifics of their product or I don't need to know about financial institutions because what I talk about is I talk about the humans who run it.
Correct.
And I go, you know, and which is what you discovered, irrespective of what you sell or what your service or product or program or what you do is, whether or not you're a foot soldier or a leader or the CEO, will you stop messing around with that? You know that's making loud noise over there, right? Sure. You know that? Melissa's going to punch you in the face. I'm only kidding. She's playing with her microphone.
She's getting comfortable. I'm settling in for the afternoon.
Welcome back. It's hour 9 of the Steph Prem podcast. We're fucked. Get us some carbs down here.
Well, if you just stick to the same question.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I know. I do waffle.
We were making fun of you earlier.
My long-winded point is if we don't manage us,
yes.
then we're not going to be a good leader, good boss, good mum, good dad.
Spot on.
Good creator, gym owner, whatever. If we are physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, socially a 3 out of 10, we can't go and do a 10 out of 10 job at work. And I think that's... You know, that's what you discovered in it. And I think ladies make it harder for themselves because they go, oh, no, if I look, that's no, I'm being selfish. And correct. I go, you are not being selfish. Mm. You're actually being smart because the better shape you're in, physically, mentally, emotionally, the better you're going to be for kids.
So it's
the better you're
going to
be or for your
selfish.
Staff or for your business or for your whatever it is, you know.
Self-service is absolutely imperative to, I think, survival.
Now, before we let you go, you're probably looking across the desk going...
You need to tell me yours.
Oh, what? Which one?
Yeah, I want to know what...
My fuck up?
You fuck up, and then your best thing that you did. The best thing you did.
Oh, the best thing I did. All right, so I started... I started Harper's as a standalone physical premises, as a studio in 1990. The thing that I did wrong... I'm going to say almost wrong and right, was I kind of didn't have a plan. I didn't have a business development plan. I just opened the doors and went, you know what? I used to work at this gym, which was a nice gym, but it was just not very practical for training the ladies. Most of my clients were ladies. Maybe 75% of my clients were women. And I'm training them at this gym, which is very nice, but it's a public gym. And, you know, 4:30 in the arvo, there's 300 men in there who all stink. And who will want the bench press, the lat pull and the fucking hack squat or whatever. I'm going, sorry, Gail, we'll just have to wait, you know. And she's like, oh, it stinks in here.
Just
I'm like,
to the left, Gail.
Yes, yes, it does, you know. But I think that what I out of not really, like just diving in, I had to sink or swim.
Yes.
So I made a lot of fuck-ups in the first year, a lot of fuck-ups. I had, my knowledge was so minimal that I remember sitting with my accountant who was explaining stuff to me and he may as well have been speaking German. And he goes, all right. And he just stops and just stops talking and taps his fingers on the table and he goes, have you got like an exercise book or something? And I go, yeah, I think so. And I just fuck off and I come back with an exercise book and he goes, cool. Have you got a big black text? And I go, yep. So he writes on the front of the exercise book, money in. And then he writes on the back, upside down, so I can write, you know, both money out.
Love it.
And he rules it up and he goes, date.
Time.
The thing that you bought.
Items.
How much it was.
Yeah.
So what you spent the money on, the date, and how much money it was, and keep the receipts. And over here, you know, and I went, oh, I can do that. He's like, fuck. So I was, that was my level of administrative understanding and awareness. Mm. And he goes, so just keep all your receipts, keep that, and I'll see you every 8 weeks and we'll figure it out. I'm like, oh, okay. So, ta-da, I've got a system.
Everyone's got their strength, though,
right? Everyone's got a system. Mm-hmm. And then managing staff. Hiring, firing, tax. I'm like, what? You know, and
back onto the squat press. Thanks, Gail.
Yeah. So there was that. But I learned more in 1 year of owning my own business than I learned in, or what was I then? 27. So I guess 9 years of doing other jobs for other. Mm. And not that I didn't learn anything. I learned a fair bit in those 9 years of working under other people's kind of banners and, you know, even working for myself in other people's gyms. Mm. But the moment I went, okay, so I've got a key to this door and this joint's mine. It's mine. Mm-hmm. It's like no one else, just me. Mm. That was just like a year of hard learning.
Mm.
But also in the middle of that joy, going, oh, so I can do this here.
Well, it's a joy when you work it out and then you get it right sometimes and you go, oh my. And it's like, I am capable.
Mm.
It's this proof to yourself sometimes that you go, and then you go, if I can do this, anyone can do it.
And if I came in with, okay, I've got a guy or a girl who does my books and I've got this marketing dude and I've got a PR dude and I've got a cleaner and I've got, you know, I've got a manager who's organized and I had none of it.
No.
Like I cleaned the toilets at the gym.
Yep.
Like people go to me, oh, who does the bathrooms? They're really good. I go, me. They go, you. I go, yep. 4 o'clock, 4:30. You know, fucking rubber gloves, Ajax, me. Yep. Who vacuums? Me. Who cleans the mirrors? Me. Who opens up, locks up? Me. Mm. Who, you know, and so it's, and I'm not trying to sound like a hero. There's nothing heroic because, again, it's just the slog.
Well, you said you don't have any of these things. You don't have cleaners. You don't have accountants. You don't have any. You don't have cash flow either.
No.
Because you're a startup. Mm. So you become everything. You learn to wear 10 hats to manage one thing and you have to be all of those things.
Well, this is how disorganized I was. I got to the point where, because I was only doing 1 hour sessions and I already had momentum because I had clients at the gym that I was working at and which were my clients, not theirs. So I didn't steal anyone. They were all members. They came to me to be trained. Then they joined the gym. So the gym didn't even offer personal training. So no one missed out. So when I moved, they came with me. Well, in the first week, I did 55 hours
on the floor.
Of PT on the floor. Plus, I've got to do all the other aforementioned shit. Then by about week three, when everyone's going, gee, it's nice here. It's like it's very clean. It's very bright. It's very light. And there's just me and Craig, or there's just us, you know, because I train one, two, or three. But essentially, and then I went, like week three, I'm going, all right, well, this week I worked about 90 hours, including all my other stuff.
Correct.
I'm like, all right, well, I might be dead by Tuesday. I didn't even think about staff.
No.
I went, And there were no, this is in 1990. I don't know. I'm not positive. I don't know if you'd know. You weren't even born. That's annoying. Oh, you were two. Yeah. Looking at Melissa. My shoes are older than her. But, yeah, I don't think there are any qualifications. As in, I don't think there was an industry standard in 1990, so 28 years ago. Maybe there were accreditations you could do, but nothing was set in stone. So I essentially had to get one of my mates who trained a lot and was pretty smart, and I trained him to be a trainer.
Yeah, yeah.
I went, well, I'm going to turn you into a trainer in about a week. You know, he already trained. He already had a basic understanding of, you know, anatomy and physiology and food. But in terms of being a trainer, so I turned him into a trainer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just went from there. And you just figure it out. Because there's no, especially when you go, okay, so this is the first PT studio in the country. I can't go and have a look at that other one. Because it ain't there.
There's no R&D here.
Yeah, there's no. Well, the R&D is me.
Is me.
Yeah. And
I am the research and I am the development.
Yeah, this is the laboratory.
So gloves back on and off we go, Gail. Another 10, thanks.
Thanks, Gail.
You just keep going.
All right, now, if people want to find you, people want you to work with their company team, they want you to inspire them, what's the best contact for you?
My best contact is... you can contact me via my Instagram. You can contact me via my management, but probably the best way to go is studiopp.com.au. That's the studio, and that will give you the links to find everything that you need to find. My blog is premium-performance.com, and that's where you find a little bit more about what I like to eat, do, train, play, enjoy, and all the fun stuff. But the best way to go or to find me on the floor most of the time in my own business is at Studio PP, which is in South Yarra in Melbourne. And I'd love you to come and see what I do. Otherwise, I head out to, like you said, a lot of offices and do a lot of corporates, a lot of keynotes, and a lot of motivational, inspiring type of work as well for your workplace or for your team.
Perfect. And are you about to launch or have launched an online something?
Have launched. So launched last year. Towards the end of last year, an online training program. So you can, if you're nowhere near South Yarra, you can't get to Studio PP, you can train with me online. The link is in my bio on my Instagram page, and it's called the Energy and Performance Program with Steph Prem, and it's 4 weeks to a better, healthier you, and it comes with meal plans and training programs, and it includes some things that are a little different. So you get Pilates, you get HIIT, you get bar, you get different kind of workout modalities that can help you over the 4 weeks.
And if people want to go straight to if people want to go straight to Insta to just check you out,
Steffi Prem
at Steffi Steffie
Prem
at Steffi Prem. Now you probably noticed looking across the table how I seem to defy age.
It's weird that you said that. I was actually just thinking that. You read my mind.
What else were you thinking?
How did you know? That's weird.
Well, thanks, Steph.
So intuitive.
What? How do you do it? I hear you ask. Thank you. Fucking hell. I prepped you for this. You're shit at this.
Wow, Craig.
Yeah, go on.
How do you do it?
Yeah, like perfect. Craig? Well, Steph, I do it with Maxes.
Wow, tell me more about Maxes, Craig.
You're shit. Maxes, of course, sponsor the webcast, Maxes and Maxines, and we love them because they give us money. No, that's not, well, we love them because we love their products, we love what they stand for, their ethos, and they've been on the Australian nutritional sup landscape for a few decades, and they have been helping people get in shape for a very long time, almost as long as me. So I use the Max's sups, I use the protein powders, I use the bars, and I just got a box of cookies this week, which, have you ever had a Max's?
Where was the cookies?
Have you,
You waited an hour into the show to mention cookies.
Have you not even, I'm being serious, have you ever tried the their cookies? They
no,
have oh. the chocolate one and the cookies and cream and like...
Rude not to.
Do you remember in the old days we had wagon wheels?
Yes.
Well, better. Like you go, this can't be a protein bar. Like this has got to be, yeah, amazing. I mean, like the cookies are ridiculous. So I'll give you one before you leave. It'll cost you $15. So anyway, guys, if you're in the market for some quality sups, protein powders, pre-workouts, all those kinds of things. Do they have a post? I don't know. They have a lot of good stuff. I'm mainly the protein guy. But anyway, go to www.maxinesburn.com. That's for the ladies and for the dudes and for the girls who want to see what the dudes are taking. You can, whatever. Maxes.com.au. So www.maxinesburn.com and maxes.com.au. Maxes, thanks. Steph, it's been terrific.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kragos.